I wanted to begin by recalling that in our, I can enlarge it.
Yeah.
Haven't gotten to that yet. In our pursuit of a philosophy of evolution, dash mind and supermind, we are speaking about the evolution of mind. That's our current topic. And the question that we're now asking is, what is mind? So that was the question that was raised in the last session last week. And we reviewed a bit of Conrad Lorenz and the emergence of mind in lower species. Then I recommended that we read from the Synthesis of Yoga about 3 pages, which define citta, manas, and buddhi. And I told you the page numbers and the title of the chapter. So I would like to see hands now indicating who did that reading.
Before.
Okay, now that's interesting because last week I asked and there were no hands regarding the previous week's reading assignment.
I did something different.
Oh, there's always one of those.
Because I have already packed my books so I couldn't read it. So I'm going. So what I did, I said, you know, I never thought about what is mind. And each time when I started thinking, and I said to myself, what is mind? What is mind? Driving bicycle, what is mind? And I got 2 answers, which later on I find in, I don't know what book it was, something from Aurobindo, he confirmed that. But then I know what is mind, and then I said, okay, what is inner mind? Because there are 2 minds, the outer mind and the inner mind. So, or the inside mind. So now I'm trying to find out what is my inner mind, and there are no answers yet. It is not coming up. And I have constantly to say, what is inner mind? What is
very
inner
good
mind?
Yeah.
I know it will come up,
so,
but it's not there.
Edith, this is exactly
what you asked.
What I asked people to do, except that, in fact, a lot is known about what mind is. And the philosophical approach is to gather, to assemble what is known experientially and theoretically, and to allow what is known to be assimilated into one's perception, and then to gradually shift away from the frame of what is known to a direct perception of what is. That's really the philosophical method. And it's much easier, Sri Aurobindo is asking us to do this, because it's very effective. And someone like Conrad Lorenz or William James or Sri Aurobindo, who has been a genius, who has put together a good understanding of these things for provides many useful keys. And so what you just said you were unable to do could be enhanced by this process of gathering and dwelling. Okay. Sri Aurobindo uses the phrase gathering and dwelling. Heidegger uses the phrase gathering and dwelling. Whitehead uses the phrase gathering and dwelling. And the three didn't read each other's work at all. So this is the philosophical method. And it has a point. And this is the main thing that I want to reiterate tonight. I have an objective in mind, in my mind. I have a goal for this group. And it is not just to review philosophical ideas. The goal that I have in mind is to pursue an opening to direct, intuitive perception of the truth of evolution. And the idea, as Sri Aurobindo said to us in the first night here, in this method of jnana yoga, the yoga of truth consciousness, it helps to begin with the idea and then to follow a path of knowledge that ends up with the direct perception of the thing itself that we want to know. So if we believe everything that we've heard in these courses so far about the limited nature of the rational mind, which Bergson began with 100 years ago, if we believe any of that, then we know that the rational mind is a tool that evolution has brought us to in order to progress beyond to another level of mind and eventually supermind. So Sri Aurobindo is going to reiterate this path tonight in the words that we read. And we will be reiterating this path till we get to the end of this path. And I don't mean the end of hearing about it. I mean the doing of it to its end. The end of philosophy. The evolution of mind. That's what we want. We don't just want to hear about it anymore. So my goal in this group is to try to move in the direction of an evolving mind.
And what about the rest of the being?
Don't get into a big hurry here. because Sri Aurobindo has told us that there is a first step and a necessary condition. So we're just going to try to take the first step and fulfill the necessary condition. And if it works the way he says that it should work, then we can confidently move towards all the rest. But we cannot move towards all the rest without taking the first step and fulfilling the first condition. And so all these ignorant human beings running around on the earth expecting there to be an apocalypse, you know, are just like they have been for the last so many millennia, you know, running around in circles and repeating their habitual patterns, most of which came from a lower species to start with, and waiting for the apocalypse. So, that's not what I'm talking about here. I am instigating a movement of consciousness in the direction of the evolution of mind. That's my intention. And so if it works, we will find ourselves poised for an evolutionary effort that we grasp fully and that causes us to be energized in a way that is not mental. My goal is to bring us to that point of energization that is not mental. So, I'm launching a course here for a practical outcome. Now, I'm going to jump ahead, especially for your sake, madam, because you want to get to the end before we take the first step. So here is a part of the end. And I'm only bringing it in right now to keep Vladimir's interest, because if we don't have something to argue about, then it won't be fun. The higher mind in its aspect of cognition. Now, why would Sri Aurobindo say, bother to qualify the higher mind in this way? In its aspect of cognition. Anybody know?
Repeat, please.
Why would Sri Aurobindo bother to qualify the higher mind in its aspect of cognition? Because there is also the aspect of will in the higher mind. The higher mind is also the higher will. And the buddhi is also the will of the human being. And so these aspects of mind that we're talking about are not just cognitive. So even at the animal level, the manas and the citta are not just cognitive, they're all leading to an immediate purpose, action. Mind always qualifies action. It doesn't just be mind. It's involved in all the levels. So you cannot think about a liberated mind very easily apart from liberating first the body and the vital. With the mind, so that the mind can move on without being pulled down by the vital and the physical habits in which it evolved. So it has brought along with it all of these habits. And so we're going to talk about that mainly tonight. But first, there is also the aspect of will, of dynamic effectuation of the truth. Effectuation of the truth. What could that possibly mean? How we live, what we do. Here we find that this greater, more brilliant mind works always on the rest of the being. The mental will, the heart and its feelings, the life, the body, through the power of thought, through the idea force. This is the principle of the transformation of consciousness. In Sri Aurobindo's yoga, it's from the top down. So, Then I wanted to move, anyway, towards Vladimir's point last time. Above the higher mind is the illumined mind, and this is where I hope we're headed. Okay, I hope that we don't just turn around here in the old rational mind. But in this chapter from the Life Divine, we get all of this idea of obstacles. In each stage of the ascent, the object of the buddhi, which we're going to be reading about primarily tonight, is this. In order to allow at all to the higher light an adequate entry and force of working, it is necessary to acquire a power for quietude of the nature, to compose, tranquilize, impress a controlled passivity, or even an entire silence on mind and heart, life and body. And this imposition, without which there can be no penetration of a higher power of consciousness, is effectuated by the mind only. We'll see that tonight. So the reason why we need to liberate the mind by knowing the mind is so that it can control the life and the body. About thought and language, because we were entering into that discussion a bit, I just wanted to suggest that in these later chapters of the Life Divine, which we'll come to in another week, I'm jumping ahead, Sri Aurobindo specifies the nature of higher mind and illumined mind and intuitive mind and overmind. He specifies their natures, just like we have been specifying the nature of rational mind and pragmatic mind and vital mind and so on. So we'll have the whole stairway here. But what we really want to do is begin to focus on ourselves and our lives and the world around us and learn to identify immediately and spontaneously every movement in nature, our nature and others' natures and around us, every movement that indicates to us some aspect of mind, so that we come into a full, direct, immediate grasp of evolutionary mind in its present condition, with all of its qualifications, all of its habitual formations, all of its patterns of working, so that we are not thinking about mind as an abstract category of understanding at all, but we are engaged fully in the direct perception of mind itself. That's the step that we need to take. And it's very preliminary. Anyway, the illumined mind, he says, does not work primarily by thought, but by vision. Thought is here only a subordinate movement, expressive of sight. The human mind, which relies mainly on thought, conceives that to be the highest or the main process of knowledge, thought. But in the spiritual order, thought is a secondary and not indispensable process. Thought is dispensable. It's not necessary. In its form of verbal thought, it can almost be described as a concession made by knowledge to the ignorance. because that ignorance is incapable of making truth wholly lucid and intelligible to itself in all its extent and manifold implications, except through the clarifying precision of significant sounds. But I want us to realize that the aim of philosophy, and especially a philosophy of the evolution of mind, is to realize that, first of all, before it has any ideas or says any words, it perceives what is. Spatially, what's there in front of you? How far away is it? How efficiently can you grasp it and eat it? How sure are you that that person just cheated you? You're damn sure because you saw it happen. You don't have to have a complex psychology of morality to perceive that. So, first we perceive things that are. Now we get so involved in our complex analysis of how things are that we forget that they are what they are. And it's also the same with mind. Mind is something that we can perceive directly in all of its levels of activity and know directly for what it is. We don't have to speculate about what it is. And that is also true of higher mind and intuitive mind and overmind. These things, the truth, when Sri Aurobindo writes truth with a capital T, he means the thing itself. He doesn't mean what we know about it or what we think about it or how we systematize our understanding of it. What Sri Aurobindo means by truth is the thing itself. So, this is something that, if known by the illumined mind, is a sight. It is a seeing of the totality of the thing itself, not thinking about it or analyzing it. No thought involved, and in order to see the thing itself requires a lot of energy, but a much more refined energy than the one that we use to define things. And it doesn't mean just seeing with the physical eye. It means seeing with the integral vision. The truth of the thing itself. And when we start doing that, then we are evolving. And as long as we are not doing that, chances are we are not evolving. We're just repeating the patterns that have already evolved, which we're very attached to. And we get all kinds of joy and sorrow from repeating. So,
I have a question. Why does he put ignorance with capital I?
Because that is that's how he defines the human evolution at this point. It's an evolution which partially knows things, which is predominantly false in its knowledge, which believes and values things which are in themselves not valuable and not true. That's how we live. So, I just wanted to spend a minute on this.
Well, to explain something more here, the knowledge to the ignorance is see concession made by knowledge to the ignorance, because that ignorance is incapable of making truth only lucid and intelligible to itself in all its extent and manifold implications, except through the clarifying precision of significant sound.
Yeah. So let's go on to the end of the statement. It cannot do, that is to say, the ordinary mind, it cannot do without this device to give to ideas an exact outline and an expressive body, to give to ideas, which are mental impressions, an exact outline and an expressive body for communicating.
Manifestation.
Yeah, that, right, that's the ordinary perception of manifestation. But it is evident that this is a device, a machinery. Thought in itself, in its origin, on the higher levels of consciousness, is a perception, a cognitive seizing of the object, or of some truth of things, which is a powerful but still a minor and secondary result of spiritual vision, a comparatively external and superficial regard of the self upon the self. All I want to suggest here is that what he's indicating for the higher planes of consciousness is that above mind, which depends a lot on language, there is higher mind, which depends on thought independent of language, and above that higher thought mind is a vision mind, which grasps directly the thing itself in its atemporal dimensions. That means the totality of the thing itself, past, present, and future, potential and actual, good and bad, evolving and evolved, and the thing itself, such as evolution, for example, such as divine love, such as integral yoga, not in its concept, not in its description, but in its totality of being. It's energy. It's an energy field which has innumerable spatio-temporal formations, and somehow it's possible to grasp in those spatio-temporal formations a vision of the thing itself, which is not just a vision of the thing itself, but which is the thing itself. And that's not physical vision, that is comprehensive, conscious grasp of the truth of the thing itself.
The beauty of this statement, everything what you say, it is as it is. Yes? But the beauty of this statement is that it is by this device that the low mind ignorance, that's why it's from capital I,
yeah,
that it is a device which is to manifest that particular vision in precision and detail.
Yeah. So, what we're going to do tonight is we're going to follow a precise verbal description of citta, manas, and buddhi. And we're also going to be told by Sri Aurobindo why it is important for us to understand these things mentally, in order for us to be able to move in the direction of those other levels of consciousness, which at the moment we normally don't have access to, we don't grasp, we don't live by those other levels of consciousness. Sometimes we get glimpses of them, but according to the idea of integral yoga, It's possible to do more than get occasional glimpses of them. It's possible to enter into them and allow their energy to penetrate all the levels of our life. If you're living in the energetic grasp of the truth of evolution and higher mind, that is going to change the way you live. If you are seeing the past and the present and the future as one continuum, trikal drishti, that, as I mentioned before, is going to change the way you metabolize. It's going to change the way you make decisions about what you do. You're going to be relating always to the potential and not to just some partial manifestation of something. This is the state of genius in which some human beings have the privilege of living sometimes. But to make that way of living an evolutionary generality is Sri Aurobindo's goal. And so he's going to tell us what we need to do in order to make that possible. And if we think that it can be done without doing what we need to do, then we are deluded. So, let's try to take this opportunity to move in a certain direction of consciousness. I am going to go to the part which I requested you to read, and not read the whole thing, but just pick out some passages so that we begin to conceptualize the different levels of consciousness that have evolved in us up to now, that are dominant in us, because we are the mental being. And all of these things which he describes, we know intimately. We don't bother to focus on them very much. We take them for granted, and we automatically allow them to do their work in us like they have been doing for probably a million years. And there have just been slight changes in the way they do these things. So, if we don't know that very well, then how can we expect to find another way of functioning? It's just common sense. And Sri Aurobindo doesn't pretend to be the only one who knows these things. So on page 647 in the old dispensation, how did we get there? Thank you. Okay, now don't look at the screen, everybody, because I don't want to give you vertigo. But this chapter, this section of the synthesis of yoga is called The Psychology of Self-Perfection. Now, we may not be interested in that, in which case, there's no point in reading this. But if we are interested in that, then I think we should take what he says seriously, because he is the expert. I'm just almost there now, so you can entertain yourself by contemplating on your mind right now. You see, You see, this comment that she made is a spontaneous comment of the pragmatic mind. And the pragmatic mind, as we will see, is a kind of first level above perception. And it's very closely related to perception. So you're perceiving something, and your perception of that which is in front of you leads you to make a suggestion regarding how a particular end can be achieved more efficiently. This is precisely what happens all the time when we're functioning at that interface between manas and buddhi. So we will hear a description of that now, but what I want us to do is to reflect on what we do and identify these patterns. There's a sentence in here that we'll come to in a minute where Sri Aurobindo says it's very important to analyze how our minds function in order to allow the higher buddhi to impose a higher will on those functions. That's all we're trying to learn here. We'll come to that statement. So, citta. The basic consciousness is largely subconscient. Okay, now everybody realize that citta is a term for something that is the basic movement of consciousness. Whatever consciousness is, what is consciousness? 100 books on the shelves today are asking this question. What is consciousness? So here is an answer. The basic consciousness. It has open and hidden two kinds of action, one passive or receptive, the other active or reactive and formative. As a passive power, it receives all impacts, even those of which the mind is unaware or to which it is inattentive, and it stores them in an immense reserve of passive subconscient memory on which the mind, as an active memory, can draw. It is a nervous substance that has evolved over billions of years. It is present in every form of life, and it receives impacts of the world around it passively and actively reacts to those stimuli. This is what Conrad Lorenz talks about throughout all of his work, cognition at the subconscious, molecular, cellular, organismic level, constantly going on. Every impulse in the environment right now is being registered by our citta, which knows very well how to cope with it because it has sat in many classrooms since it was 6 years old. But ordinarily the mind draws only what it had observed and understood at the time. More easily, what it had observed well and understood carefully, this it can easily pull out of its subconscious memory. Less easily, what it had observed carelessly or ill understood, At the same time, there is a power in consciousness to send up to the active mind for use what that mind had not at all observed or attended to, or even consciously experienced. We are loaded with impressions in the citta that suddenly we may call up under certain circumstances if needed, but otherwise it's all subconscious. So I'm going to skip now down to even the whole constitution. Let's see if I can find that. Yes, there it is. Okay, here's the essential thing to know. Even the whole constitution of our life and body may be described as a bundle of habits formed by the past evolution in nature. Sri Aurobindo got this idea from William James. William James wrote a magnificent book in 1890 called The Principles of Psychology. And he goes into detail in explaining a theory of evolution based upon the formation of habits. And this was widely communicated during the period of time that Sri Aurobindo was reading James and Bergson and Haeckel and everybody else. And he wrote a letter saying, I read that book and I got many useful suggestions from it. One of the useful suggestions that he obviously got from it, because you can find passages that are almost identical in that book, which I have and have been reading, and read when I was 15 years old. Magnificent book. We will refer to it many times in this course. The mother also uses this idea frequently in her writings. The idea that all of our organs, all of our systems, our whole cellular evolution is based upon the formation of habit. So the organism in its evolution develops habits that allow it to survive. And it passes on the structural, organic information to its offspring, the structural, organic information. Okay? There is no difference between the way an organ functions or an organism functions, or a species functions. There's no difference between that and its stored information. It reacts and responds to its environment habitually, automatically, subconsciously, because it has evolved an understanding, a knowledge, a citta vritti, that knows how to live in its environment. And we are the result of all the species evolution that has taken place prior to us. And so most of what we do, we don't think about at all. We just are that understanding called the human being. And so we make all kinds of decisions and judgments subconsciously because we don't have to think about most of the things that we do. We don't think about how to make our heart beat. But it knows pretty well how to do that. Even the whole constitution of our life and body may be described as a bundle of habits formed by the past evolution in nature, even before there were hearts and brains. You know, even before there were hearts and brains, there were habits that were formed that made it possible for hearts and brains to form. And held together by the persistent memory of this secret consciousness. For citta, the primary stuff of consciousness, the primary stuff of consciousness. Consciousness has a substratum. You know, there's this hulomorphe, if you know some Greek. Hulomorphe. There's the form and there is the substance under it. And the substance makes the form, but the form determines the substance. Hylomorphism in English. But in fact, all action of the mind or inner instrument arises out of this citta. Ooh, how about that? All action of the mind, in fact, arises out of this citta, or basic consciousness. Partly conscient, partly subconscient, or subliminal to our active mentality. When it is struck by the world's impacts from outside, or urged by the reflective powers of the subjective inner being, it throws up certain habitual activities. That's exactly what happened a while ago when you said that I could do that. You were receiving impressions. Your mind picked up a subconscious memory about how something could be done, and you said, made that suggestion. All those subconscious impressions you were not aware of, but they were all activated in you by the circumstances around you. No, right. But at the moment when you said it, you were not conscious. No, Margit, when you said it, you were not conscious of the activation of the citta in your nervous system that brought together to your mind those impressions and allowed you to immediately formulate an idea.
But the other thing was also that
you... Okay. Now, I want to move down to Manas, page 650. But I really suggest that you read all of this section. Manas, the sense mind. So, all of this citta has evolved in us sight, hearing, touch, taste, and a kind of subtle, unified sense of what that is in front of us, which is a combination of two or more senses normally, sometimes all five, sometimes no sense at all, but an impression that comes to us purely, but that's another subject. Anyway, it's still manas, it's still sense mind.
But he said somewhere here that they are not the instruments of the mind.
No, they are the instruments of the mind, absolutely. So we're going to come to that right now. No, yeah, we'll come to that statement. Actually, it's right here. Sight, hearing, taste, smell, touch are really properties of the mind, not of the body. But properties of the mind, not of the body, means that the body has evolved these properties of mind, perception. But the body is still doing it. It's not for the sake of being a body that it's doing it, it's for the sake of being a mind that it's doing it, but they are totally integrated. So there is no mind without body, so far. Manas, the sense mind, depends in our ordinary consciousness on the physical organs of receptive sense for knowledge, and on the organs of the body for action directed towards the objects of sense. So we perceive something, as Vladimir was saying earlier, and then we move towards it. The moving towards it is the body. The perceiving it and thinking about it is the mind in the body. And then there's the will to move towards it that comes from the processing of the information. And then what moves towards it is not just the mind by itself, it takes the body along with it. The superficial and outward action of the senses is physical and nervous in its character, and they may easily be thought to be merely results of nerve action. They are sometimes called in the old books pranas, nervous or life activities. So this is all of our ordinary functions. But sense mind is actually more than that.
There was a next statement.
Yeah, there are many interesting statements. I want to go to this one. Sight, hearing, taste, smell, touch are really properties of the mind, not of the body. But the physical mind, which we ordinarily use, limits itself to a translation into sense of so much of the outer impacts as it receives through the nervous system and the physical organs. But the inner manas has also a subtle sight, hearing, power of contact of its own, which is not dependent on the physical organs. That is subtle perception. Okay? I don't want to spend a lot of time on manas because I want to get to buddhi here.
And this, indriyas, so it's a bit different, that indriyas are not only properties of the mind, they also have their properties of consciousness.
Well, they're properties of the body.
And consciousness.
Consciousness is totally integrated in the body. There is no consciousness without the body. So, buddhi, this is what I want us to come to terms with, that all of the sense impressions, all of the vital and physical activities in which we are embodied and doing all the time are consciousness. They are not other than consciousness. Physical, vital, mental, embodied consciousness. That is consciousness. Nothing else. Now there's another level, buddhi. Buddhi, and this is all about Buddhism, by the way. Everything that we read in the next two pages is the fundamental text of Buddhism. Buddhi is a construction of conscious being which quite exceeds its beginnings in the basic citta. Okay, it begins in the basic citta, but it exceeds that. It is the intelligence with its power of knowledge and will. Buddhi takes up and deals with all the rest of the action of the mind and life and body. It is in its nature thought power and will power of the spirit turned into the lower form of a mental activity. Turned into the lower form of a mental activity. That means citta and manas and the slightly higher vibration of thought and will. So what she thought and what she willed was just slightly above the level of the bird seeing the butterfly and going there and snatching it and taking it back to her nest and giving it to her chicks. That is a level of conscious will working purely in the sense mind. But now we add to that a slightly higher level of image, understanding, and action, all closely related to what we sense and perceive and experience. Okay? We may distinguish three successive gradations of the action of this intelligence. There is first an inferior perceptive understanding which simply takes up, records, understands, and responds to the communications of the sense mind, memory, heart, and sensational mentality. Now, heart and sensational mentality is a vital function. It is the mind involved in the vital. It feels things, it likes things, it dislikes things, it wants things, it rejects things. That's the involved sensational mentality. Then the buddhi takes all of those feelings and creates by their means an elementary thinking mind which does not go beyond their data, but subjects itself to their mold and rings out their repetitions, turns round and round in the habitual circle of thought and will determined by sensation mostly, suggested by sensation mostly, or follows with an obedient subservience of the reason to the suggestions of life, any fresh determinations which may be offered to its perception and conception. These items are on sale this week. Save money, buy more. Okay, that's the level upon which the universal buddhi functions in the world today. That is its field of perception and action and understanding. I know I'm going to go and buy that dress because it's on sale and I've been looking at it for weeks. And by golly, now I'm going to satisfy that impulse. Or computer, or car, or book. But there's good news. Beyond this elementary understanding, which is the normal level of human being, which we all use to an enormous extent, that's what Sri Aurobindo means by that phrase, there is a power of arranging or selecting reason and will force of the intelligence which has for its action and aim an attempt to arrive at a plausible, sufficient, settled ordering of knowledge and will for the use of an intellectual conception of life.
That is, has nothing to do with the truth.
No, nothing to do with the truth at all. This is just a slightly more refined and organized life which figures out that it can live in this environment for a certain amount of time and do good things for the humanity around it and derive from that what it needs to fulfill its potential as a family and as a servant of society and not have to rob banks or beg on the street or reduce itself to farm labor, because it's intelligent enough to know that it can learn how the body functions and it can work in a hospital and it can help to organize that hospital to provide services to millions of people throughout life. And so there is an organization of life based upon an understanding of what is needed to make it work better. A few people function on that level. Nothing wrong with it, except that it's very, very limited in the amount of joy that it can give to the being involved in it working out in the sunshine on a tractor that keeps breaking down. And so you get into that cycle, and William James says a marvelous thing. He says, what keeps people in their social level of functioning is habit. And if it weren't for habit, people would not put up with all of that which they have to go through in order to get a little juice from the experience. But everyone gets into a certain level of a habitual mode, and once it becomes a habit, because it was a habit anyway that was passed on and presented itself by in the society, then the Eskimo, he says, can accept living in the frozen north, and the African can accept living in the desert, and the New Yorker can accept living in his flat on time, you know, near Times Square, and everyone can go through all the ritual activities that they have to go through in order to justify those habits. So as Conrad Lawrence says, then we have culture, which is a kind of mental justification, passing on a tradition that helps us to maintain these habits of society at all their different levels. That is exactly what Sri Aurobindo found described in the Buddhist texts.
But we just read that what keeps us going is the delight of existence in the life department.
What keeps us going is habit.
Well, behind it all,
which we delude ourselves by believing is joyful. Okay, no. Some souls have the destiny during this period of human evolution of living in a desert. But destiny is another question entirely. We are talking about evolution. And the different subspecies of humanity have settled into different niches as a result of animal evolution, and after so many millennia of working within those patterns, other patterns have become possible. And so all the levels of human society that we know, which exist today, are there as supports that helped us get to where we are now. And we have in ourselves memories of all those levels which humanity has passed through. And then...
On this point with the habits, I was in the last days also over, the habits have also a very positive function, I think, to calm the mind, to act out it and live the joy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it is a positive aspect that our habit you need to experience the joy of mind, life, and body.
Absolutely. Evolution is a process of the divine. Evolution is a process of the divine manifesting delight at every level.
But if the habit will come.
Yes, well, we certainly don't want to contradict Sri Aurobindo.
But if the habit becomes compulsive, it is limiting the development of evolution.
What's that?
If the habit becomes compulsive, it is limiting
the
evolution.
Look, as Conrad Lawrence says, there are two processes going on. One is adaptation, that's the conservative side, and the other is cognitive exploration. Okay, that's the positive side. And so the old habits have to be maintained for as long as they can be maintained under certain environmental conditions for the sake of survival and improvement and variation and delight. Because the vital power will explore every means of delight, including pain and suffering, which are delight for the truth. But sometimes the niches no longer satisfy and reinforce the compulsive behavior. And so the compulsive behavior starts to suffer instead of enjoy itself, because it no longer has enough water to drink in that desert. And so then it has to move to a higher region. And as a result of moving to that higher region, it finds that it doesn't need as much fur. And so it adapts to a new environment. And then it functions in that niche for as long as it can, and so on. So there's pleasure for a while, and then there's pain, and then there's change. And in Savitri, there's hardly a canto which doesn't speak about the necessity of pain in order for there to be change.
And the other point is also, you describe how the habit is, I would say, the old one. But what I see also now in experience, when I lived in West Berlin and came then together with the former Communist Party, moved over, in West Berlin there was an energy, you can learn everything, you can do everything, you have to learn and learn and learn, and it is drive, yeah? And then you came to the former Communist Party, and I said, I learned this.
Okay. Look at this word here.
This moving, this habit of moving.
Absolutely. So I want you to look at that on a more abstract level, but the same thing. Yeah. Exactly what you're saying, but on a slightly more abstract level. In spite of its more purely intellectual character, that's Marxism, this secondary or intermediate reason, that is intermediate on the upward scale, is really pragmatic in its intention. Do you know the meaning of that word, pragmatic? That's just exactly what you were describing, that society, you know, in an intellectual way, tries to create a structure that works as well as the human intellect can imagine that it could work. But then, after a while, it finds its limits. And then when it finds its limits, it's inspired to reconfigure. And in the mental evolution, that means mainly reconfiguring external arrangements. Because the inner sense of what's beautiful, what's good, what's true, all of that doesn't change very much. We have this aesthetic, rational consciousness that wants to change the outer arrangements so that we can still enjoy literature and art and be inspired and play music and have time to meditate. And when we don't have those outer structures in place, then our preferred modus vivendi is interrupted. And then we start trying to rearrange things outwardly. Of course, the mother tells us that no amount of outward rearrangement is going to achieve the goal of evolution. It's only going to achieve readaptation of what already exists. So when we're thinking about environmentalism and sustainability, we're actually not thinking about evolution per se. We're thinking about readaptation to make the replication of our current level of consciousness possible. We're thinking about replicating our species. We're not thinking about evolving. But nature is thinking about evolving.
But what you're describing here, and all of us there, I think is the reason why Buddhism wants us to get rid of all of these
absolutely
habits by what this
not just Buddhism, Sri Aurobindo also.
Sri Aurobindo too, yes, but
so we'll come to that.
So you come to Nirvana by.
We will come to it.
Okay.
And when we come to it, we will be happy that we came to it. It will be very delightful. We're coming to it actually very soon. It's in the next paragraph. But beyond it, okay, beyond this pragmatic reason and will, there is a reason, a highest action of the buddhi, which concerns itself disinterestedly with a pursuit of pure truth and right knowledge. It seeks to discover the real truth behind life and things and our apparent selves, and to subject its will to the law of truth, Buddha Dharma. Few, if any of us, can use this highest reason with any purity, but the attempt to do it is the topmost capacity of the inner instrument. Please don't take those words lightly.
How to do it?
Okay, first let's recognize that this is the top capacity of your inner instrument. Buddhi is really an intermediary between a much higher truth mind, not now in our active possession, which is the direct instrument of spirit, and the physical life of the human mind evolved in body. Its powers of intelligence and will are drawn, this the body's powers of intelligence and will are drawn from this greater direct truth mind or supermind. Truth mind, capital T, that's the one we were talking about a while ago, the direct knowing of what is. That's the truth mind. This buddhi, this higher intelligence, is just below that possibility which Sri Aurobindo spoke about just a moment ago in The Life Divine as higher mind, illumined mind, intuitive mind, which he says in that passage are the lower range of supermind. It's a different way of being and knowing, a different cognition and a different willpower force energy. But the buddhi is the direct connection to that. And it's in the body. It's not different from the body. The buddhi is in the body. And it is able to contact those higher ranges of consciousness, which can also be in the body, but not until it makes the contact. Buddhi centers its mental action round the ego idea. See if I want to do this. Let me just jump down a little bit here.
Okay.
This is what I was saying. But when the highest reason and will develop, we can turn towards that which these outward things mean. We can turn towards that which these outward things mean to the higher spiritual consciousness. The eye can then be seen as a mental reflection of the self, the spirit, the divine, the one existence, transcendent, universal, individual, in its multiplicity. The consciousness in which these things meet become aspects of one being and assume their right relations, can then be unveiled out of all these physical and mental coverings.
But existence must become very boring at the moment where all the truth is being given.
Now, I just want to cross over into the next... Yeah, it does. Definitely. The external one. Okay, now, this is the bridge to the next chapter, and I wanted to recommend that you read the next chapter, called Purification, the Lower Mentality. There are two chapters here, the purification of the lower mentality and the purification of the buddhi. These two chapters are absolutely crucial for an understanding of the evolution of mind.
Purification.
It's chapter 6 and chapter 7 of this book of perfection, of the self-perfection. Okay, in the Synthesis of Yoga, the Yoga of Self-Perfection, chapters 6 and 7. But let me just reinforce what we just said. And we'll close with this. Which instrument, then, by its purification and perfection, will bring about most easily and effectively, or can aid with the most powerful rapidity, the perfection of the rest? You asked about what about all the rest? Okay. Which instrument can bring about the perfection of all the rest most effectively? Since we are the spirit enveloped in mind, that means Buddha Manas Citta, a soul evolved here as a mental being in a living physical body, it must naturally be in the mind, the antahkarana, that we must look for this desideratum, this thing, this object. And in the mind, it is evidently by the buddhi, the intelligence and the will of the intelligence, that the human being is intended to do whatever work is not done for him by the physical or nervous nature, as in the plant and the animal. Pending the evolution of any higher supramental power, the intelligent will must be our main force for effectuation, and to purify it becomes a very primary necessity. Now, I'm going to read something from the next page about Buddhism, which is not called Buddhism here, because Sri Aurobindo is not prescribing an established religious formula, but he's telling us what that established religious formula is meant to do. It is meant there is a just and permissible, a quite legitimate human enjoyment of these things being everything in life, especially the higher things like poetry and music and art, which is to speak in the language of Indian psychology, that is to say Buddhism, predominantly sattvic in its nature. Sattvic enjoyment is a permissible activity of the buddhi, not vital enjoyment and physical enjoyment, which have to be pretty much totally purified, but sattvic enjoyment, which is somewhat involved in the vital and the physical, you know, the drive to create beauty, is a vital physical impulse that is driven by the buddhi. It is an enlightened enjoyment, principally by the perceptive, aesthetic, and emotive mind, secondarily only by the sensational, nervous, and physical being. But all, okay, physical, nervous, sensational, emotive, aesthetic, perceptive, all subject to the clear government of the Buddhi, to a right reason, a right will, a right reception of the life impacts, a right order, a right feeling of the truth, law, ideal sense, beauty, use of things. The mind gets the pure taste of enjoyment of them and rejects whatever is perturbed, troubled, and perverse. This is essential Buddhist practice. This is the teaching of the liberated Buddhi, the mastered Buddhi. Now, he goes on to tell us how that movement of mastery leads directly to the higher mind, which leads directly to the illumined mind and intuitive mind and supramental descent. That comes right next, right after this. We're not going to go there tonight because we're 10 minutes over time right now. But what I want us to do is to observe closely all these different patterns of typical mental behavior that we have been reading about in ourselves and in others, and recognize directly, perceptively, mind in its evolved embodiment in life, in us and around us now. And from that concrete, direct perception, we will begin to focus on other powers of mind that can be invited into these domains. But he tells us very specifically that we cannot invite those higher powers of mind into all of these other levels until we know them intimately, know their patterns, know those habits of functioning, grasp completely all of these movements of mind that we embody, and reflect upon them dispassionately, and dissociate ourselves from them all, and allow another dynamic to interpenetrate the vehicle that's formed already by those patterns. To use the will of the Buddhi to dissociate itself from all the evolved patterns of mind is what he says is the key, the essential movement. To use the Buddhi to dissociate from all those patterns which are well evolved, and at that moment, it becomes possible to have a larger, more universal thought perception of reality. Because until we do that, our thought perception of reality is predetermined by all the already evolved existing patterns of mind. But Buddhi has the power to observe them dispassionately, dissociate itself and allow another energy, thought, understanding to invade. And it can hold in abeyance all of the already evolved patterns. And that's its job. In the integral yoga, that's its job. To purify and liberate the buddhi to do that job. Instead of doing all the jobs that it's been doing for the last couple of thousand years.
But this does not mean to leave the body, because
no.
We must have the body. But it does mean that in that little gap, the body is taken care of.
Well, the buddhi is not separate from the body.
Yeah, I know it's not separate. But Buddhism kind of lets you kind of leave, doesn't it?
Not necessarily. It depends on whether you're speaking about tantric Buddhism or some other Buddhism.
I'm asking this question, because the physical body must take care.
Yeah, it's a logocentric habit of the rational mind to think that Buddhism does this but not that, and Hinduism does this and not that, and the physical must be there and not abandoned by the mind, and the mind is something evil and we need to get rid of it and just do the yoga in the body. And you know, all of these mental formations are there in us, in our mind field, all around us. They're all fine, they all do their job, but there's another job that the buddhi can do, which is to dissociate itself from all of these it should, it shouldn't formations, and hold that integral space without sanctioning any of its already evolved patterns, so that a higher energetic direct consciousness force can rearrange the field. But it's the same field. You don't leave it. You can't leave it. There is no other field.
Zen, in the beginning, he said that everything is mingling, no? The lower, the vital.
Totally mingled.
So this is the main problem, is it? Because the soul of.
Yes, it is.
Desire, which is.
Absolutely.
Blocking everything.
So. In what you'll read in these pages is that these established formations keep coming up from the physical memory from earlier species. They keep coming up from vital situations which we like and we don't like. They keep coming up from mental formations which we think are so glorious and wonderful and important and right, and you know, judgments about, you know, what you should do and what you shouldn't do. So we have to be aware of all of these things all the time. Don't reject them, don't negate them, be aware of them, but allow the buddhi to dissociate its support from all of them, at least from time to time during the day. And just experiment with what it might be like to not sanction any of those things. And the big surprise is they just keep right on going on.
That's very encouraging.
Nothing collapses, except that buddhi stands there and suddenly becomes a representative of the inner purusha and aspires for that other vaster energy to come in. And that's not just cognitive, it's also energetic consciousness. Because all consciousness is not just consciousness, it's also energy. So then there starts to take place an energy shift. And you don't feel attached to all of those formations, but you also perceive them directly for what they are, and know them and honor them and allow them to go on doing what they do, but without a sanction. Because nature is there, and nature is not going to stop rolling along in her established tracks. But the individual human being can create an opening for another energy to enter, another conscious force, which Sri Aurobindo describes as higher mind, intuitive mind, illumined mind, and that functioning can begin to become familiar. It's there. You only have to give it a chance. But you can't give it a chance until you universalize the mind. And so what I'm suggesting is a formula for universalizing the mind. You begin to observe mind at all of its levels, all of the time, and it's no longer my mind, your mind, lower mind, higher mind, and all of those things. It is just mind, universal, and it's going on all the time, and it's not going to stop. So you can afford to allow yourself to spread out into mind universal at all of its levels, even supermind, if you can manage it, to expand your bubble into that domain also, and just allow that liberated buddhi to be detached, and something wonderful will start to happen. And as soon as it starts to happen, you cognize it. You become cognizant that there's some kind of perception going on that's not the rational mind, and it's not the pragmatic mind, and it's not the vital mind, and it's not the sense mind. It's another kind of vibration that also knows things and does things, but it's coming from this universalized mind self, which is Purusha, pure self. Because it's just there behind all of those automatic functionings. And you're in it now, and you're liberated. And so that's a transition which can be made intentionally by a process of reflection and purification and self-control and active will.
Hasn't
Sterner made a step beyond that by saying, I have placed my course on this thing? If you take a step beyond that, we will all know it. Yeah, but we can get to be more conscious. And it's not that difficult.
The thing is, when you recognize or you cognize that you are in this state, it disappears.
Yeah. You can easily step out of it.
The art is that you can stay in there.
What I'm suggesting is that we practice a little bit of yoga. Simple, basic stuff. We're not calling it Vipassana. But it is a kind of Vipassana. And Samatha. And all of those traditional things.
Vipassana could be done there, but therefore it lost its meaning because it would